listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
On this evening's Lyric Feature, the story of Rachel Baptiste, a soprano who lit up the stage in Georgian Ireland but has almost disappeared from the historical record. Black Siren is presented by Sive Downs.
It's the 1750s in Dublin, the second city of the British Empire. Grand Georgian architecture encloses a city teeming with literature, drama, and music. An artistic renaissance is happening. In Ireland, a Protestant ruling class enforced penal laws, controlling the religious, political, and economic activities of Catholics. Ironically, art was free to evolve. In the February 1750 newspaper, there's an ad for a benefit concert in a Dublin pleasure garden. These were the first kind of public concerts where the privileged elite went to be entertained. Marlborough Green, the Rotunda, Portobello, Ranelagh. These pleasure garden venues always ended their gigs with a firework display. A nice touch. A new singer is on the music circuit. She is Rachel Baptiste, and she is black. And in this advert, the singer is described as a native of this country. Apart from one or two exceptions, virtually every record of Rachel Baptiste's existence and whereabouts during her lifetime comes from newspaper listings, most of which only offer us minimal descriptions. Rachel made an imprint on Irish musical life, but where she came from we don't know, and where she went begs the same question. Who was Rachel Baptiste? And even if she wasn't recorded in the history books, interest in her story is growing. This is Peter Whelan, director of the Irish Baroque Orchestra.
I'm pretty sure I came across Rachel Baptiste reading that book that's been such a source of inspiration, the Dublin Calendar, written by Boydell, which kind of lists all of the concerts in 18th century Dublin. It's kind of a compendium of lots of newspaper articles that people found at the time. So I'm always trawling through that looking for inspiration, and it has been the inspiration for a lot of the Irish Baroque Orchestra work. But actually, specifically, what jogged my memory about Rachel Baptiste was, I think during the pandemic, when we had like more time online, I saw this fascinating thread on this I think a Facebook page called Black Irish.
Black and Irish are an activism group that highlight the struggles and celebrate the successes of the black and mixed race Irish community.
And they're mentioning, you know, lots of black Irish celebrities, and they mentioned, like, this picture came up about Rachel Baptiste. I said, yeah, of course, you know, that's in our wheelhouse. That's somebody we really need to explore. And people were asking on that, and there was a thread underneath saying, you know, I wonder what she was singing, what a fascinating character. And I 100% agreed. So I said, look, we're looking at these characters from the same time. We really have to explore this fascinating woman.
The Irish Baroque Orchestra recorded an album reimagining the music that Rachel Baptiste would have sung. Concerts as we understand them now didn't exist in the 1750s. There were no playbills or set lists, so we have to guess what songs were popular to perform at the time by using the records that we do have. Newspapers. Handel's Mirth Admit Me of Thy Crew is a secular song about amusement and enjoyment. It's something we can imagine pleasure garden audiences floating around a cobblestone courtyard to. And here it is, from the Irish Baroque Orchestra album The Black Siren, sung by another Rachel, Rachel Redmond.
Mad with me, oh my crew. Mad with me, oh.
My name is Sive Downs. I have a Malawian dad and an Irish mam. I'm black and Irish, an identity that still feels like a pretty new one. But how new is it really? A few years ago, I found an article online on Rachel Baptiste, and I was pretty shocked. I wasn't sure if what I was reading could really be true, but I wanted to know more. Rachel's story brings up a lot of questions for me. Questions about history, tolerance, acceptance, and ultimately, my own identity. To think that a black woman was so accepted in Ireland over 300 years ago, well, that's changed the way I view my own history. I made this documentary with my former university lecturer, Michael Lee. I met him during my time as a music student at Trinity College Dublin. You'll hear him throughout this documentary. While this is a story about music, it's also so much more than that. It's a story about an Ireland we thought we knew, and an Ireland that was maybe more accepting than expected. Michael is talking to William Hart, a retired lecturer from the University of Ulster, who's done a lot to tell Rachel's story.
My first job was teaching philosophy in West Africa, in Sierra Leone. And while I was there, I became very interested in local traditions, masquerades, traditional art. And then writing up about it for journals, and there's a big American journal called African Arts, and they said, well, we wonder if you were doing a series on collections in museums, could you do us an article on the African collections in the National Museum of Ireland? But in the course of that, it made me conscious of these Irish people who had been in Africa. One of the things, kind of unexpectedly, while I was kind of documenting these Irish people, I was also conscious, occasionally, well, no, there's an African person who is in Ireland. So I went through newspapers looking for references to black people, either adverts advertising them as slaves, which did happen, rarely, but did happen, especially around Cork.
Black people advertised as slaves in Ireland. That's not something I expected to hear.
Out of that, I became sort of interested in particular individuals. And when I came across this account, I was just flicking through John O'Keefe's memoirs, talking about when he was a boy in Dublin in the 1750s.
John O'Keefe was an Irish writer and dramatist who would have been a kid when Rachel was performing in Dublin in the 1700s.
That there was this black woman called Rachel Baptiste, an African who was hailed, applauded by the people in the Marlborough Green Gardens, without, as he said, without mention of her sables, without mention of the fact that she was black.
My fondness for song had often led me to the concerts at Marlborough Green, Dublin. Among the many fine singers there was Rachel Baptiste, a real black woman, a native of Africa. She always appeared in the orchestra in a yellow silk gown and was heard by the applauding company with great delight, without remarks upon her sables.
I thought, wow. But I thought that was just isolated, and then I began to look elsewhere and I saw Brian Boydell with his calendar of music in Dublin. Now, Rachel Baptiste was mentioned there several times.
Rachel Baptiste promoted some of her own benefit concerts and listed her address for ticket sales as Grange Gorman Lane, then the western edge of Dublin. But how did she end up living there and ultimately living in Ireland?
Her name suggests that she ended up on a French vessel at some point and was either in a French colony or in a French city.
Michael is talking to Fionnuala O'Kane. Fionnuala is a lecturer at the UCD School of Architecture, Planning and Environmental Policy. Someone who thinks a lot about space and about people.
She may have come from one of those kind of French communities, or many of those families, the Huguenot families, were also involved in the trade. So if she was black, she may have come back from the Caribbean with some of those returning planters who brought her with them.
In a post published on St. Patrick's Day, 1750, we hear about another concert. At the Music Hall in Crow Street will be performed a concert of vocal and instrumental music, the vocal part by Miss Rachel Baptiste and accompanied in recitativo by an Indian gentleman lately arrived who condescends to show himself in public on this singular occasion. And these two performers hope to convince that the power of music is not confined to colour.
The advertisement is very economical and very sober in its language, but it's clearly, you know, hoping that the audience will appreciate that the power of music is...
is not confined to colour. Yeah, that seems to me to display a kind of openness which wasn't the case elsewhere, certainly not, I think, in London.
Eileen Aroon is a slow air popular around the time of Rachel's career that is said to date back to 1386. It's a song of praise for a young woman, a woman of many charms. She is fair, she can dance, she can sing, and has that crucial quality sought by balladeers. Constancy. It's something we know she would have sung from this notice for a concert she played in Peter's Cell, in what was then English Town in Limerick City.
By particular desire of several ladies and gentlemen, and by command of the Reverend and Right Worshipful Daniel Widenham, Deputy Grand Master of the several lodges of free and accepted Masons in the city of Limerick, by permission of the Worshipful John Barrett Esquire, Mayor of Limerick, by His Majesty's Company of Comedians, for the benefit of Mr. Crow. Tomorrow, being Friday, the 28th, will be presented a tragedy called Tancred and Sigismunda by Mrs. Crow, formerly Miss Baptiste, and at the end of the play, by particular desire, Eileen Aroon by Mrs. Crow.
Soprano Clina O'Regan and harpsichordist Dylan Donegan from the TUD Conservatoire in Dublin recorded it for us in their on-campus studio in Grange Gorman, just around the corner from where Rachel would have lived. It's sung in the transliterated style that would have been familiar to Rachel's Georgian audiences, but it might sound a bit strange to those of us who know a more recent version of the song.
Look at
1757, Rachel Baptiste went to England. She returned 10 years later, but it's not necessarily clear why.
There was a black woman who was supposed to be a wonderful singer, who was recommended to Samuel Foote, the proprietor of the Haymarket Theatre. The name is not given, but we do know that there was somebody called the Blackamoor Lady who did appear in Haymarket Theatre.
The Haymarket Theatre Royal is a London West End theatre. It's been there since 1720. Blackamoor was once a term for a person of African descent. It's also a type of European decorative art that's been criticised in modern times for caricaturing people of colour.
Why didn't it go down well? Unclear. It might have been because Foote's gamble in advertising her as the Blackamoor Lady set up the audience to see this as a freak show, and they responded by hooting her off the stage. And that, I think, may have driven her back to Ireland, because at that point she left England and went back to Ireland. Is that the case? I don't know. I'm hoping that more evidence will appear, but I don't know if it will.
In 1764, a London-based publication called The Gentleman's Magazine stated that there were approximately 20,000 black people living in London at the time. So, of course, there were more black people in a much bigger city. But what William is telling us here is that maybe Ireland was more of an accepting place. Maybe this is something Rachel was thinking about as she sung The Triumphs of Hibernia.
In the background of any discussion of this period is slavery. Ireland was deeply involved in the trade of slave-produced goods, especially sugar, and profited from it. Where goods flowed, people followed.
I was actually researching Westport in the west of Ireland, and there was this extraordinary survey book where on page, I can't remember exactly, there's around 56 pages. It's not very big. It's about like 7 inches by 3 inches. And then on page 56 or so, it suddenly moves from Westport, drawing Westport, to drawing a plantation in Jamaica. Just because that book had it all bound together, you know, and the people who made the book didn't think of Ireland and Jamaica in a, you know, in a different way, or they didn't separate them in the book. I thought that we need to stop writing history in very, you know, closed nation states. So it's important to start looking at the history of all these islands together. You know, it's always there in the background, like a drumbeat, all through the 18th century, you know, that imperialism is really leaping to a different level. The level of exploitation is, you know, jumping. I think the Irish were particularly good at it, partly because they had to emigrate for various reasons throughout the 17th century, either because of Cromwell or later on because of, you know, the later period, 1688, the Glorious Revolution. There were two periods when a lot of Irish people emigrated.
The Cromwellian conquest of Ireland in 1650 resulted in the Act for the Settlement of Ireland in 1652. This meant that Catholics were barred from most public offices and they had their land confiscated. The so-called Glorious Revolution of 1688 to 89 replaced a Catholic monarch with a Protestant one. So wealthy Catholic people, they left, and some of them became involved in the slave trade.
A lot of them ended up in French ports in Nantes, La Rochelle, Bordeaux, and they became integrated very quickly. I think the Irish were especially good. They were also frequently quite wealthy, so it wasn't poor emigrants like we're used to in the 19th century in Ireland, you know, where people are totally impoverished landing in, you know, Baltimore or New York. These were actually quite wealthy people who decided to leave Ireland, took a lot of money with them to, say, Bordeaux, and then intermarried because they were frequently Catholic. They could marry with the upper-class families in Bordeaux, and that's how they became involved. But then there were also other, a lot of younger sons, if they couldn't, you know, get on in Galway, or the families would actually send them to the Caribbean because it was known by then that you could make a lot of money very quickly. There are some French slave traders like Walsh, Antoine Walsh. He was one of the kind of wild geese married in with the O'Shiels, married into the big French families in the French ports. And he became a slave trader down to the west coast of Africa and across to the Caribbean. But most families are at some point of the triangle. And, you know, so the main triangle is that you ship guns frequently or other objects to Africa, you trade those for enslaved people, then you take those across the Atlantic, you sell them there, and you pick up a load of sugar and you take that back to Europe. So families are frequently involved at, you know, one point of the triangle, but they're all complicit. So it doesn't matter where you look in the 18th century, you're somewhere on one of those triangular points. And then Ireland is so important for all the ships coming out of the Channel. You know, when they leave London and Portsmouth, the last stop is always Cork, where they pick up, you know, the salt beef, they pick up linen, brown linen to clothe the enslaved people in the Caribbean, and then they take that down straight to the Caribbean. The triangles shift and change a bit, but all those money flows are effectively like one big circular gyre, all feeding each other. And the wealth being generated is generally all being siphoned back to Europe. Europe is benefiting most.
This all helps us to find out where Rachel may have come from. And so does Finola's theory that Rachel may have been mixed race. One issue with Rachel being written out of history is that it becomes difficult to find out who she really was.
Especially actually in the more Protestant islands, would have regarded acting or anything like that very unsuitable for their daughters. So enslaved people saw an opening in the arts as a way out, I think. And also maybe for those deeply unpleasant planters who exploited their black enslaved women and who had children by them, if they became attached to those children, which some of them must have done, then they saw acting or the theatre or dance as a better life, certainly, than being a field worker. So you can see why both the enslaved people and their parents and their owners for favoured enslaved people, especially the children, especially the mixed race children, might have been encouraged to go into the theatre, which on islands like Saint-Domingue or Haiti was, you know, was a very big, actually, industry. And I suppose, well, the appeal of the exotic is also very high as well, you know, that if you're very unusual and maybe very attractive, you know, that you have currency almost in the artistic world.
It's important to mention colorism here. Colorism is the prejudice or the discrimination against individuals with a dark skin tone. This can typically happen among people within the same ethnic or racial group.
Because in the early planting period, which would have been the late 17th century, there were very few women on the islands, mm-hmm. very few white women. So, you know, we know there were logically a lot of mixed race children. So any child in the Caribbean before a certain date is likely to be mixed race.
I'm mixed race, and I've been in classical music since I was a kid. I've always felt in those spaces that I didn't really belong. I didn't really fit in there. I was always in the minority. But from what Finola is telling us, Rachel wasn't. This means that music was the only viable option for her. In a society dominated by racial divide, music would have given her choice and purpose and value. William Boyce's Tell Me Lovely Shepherd was a crowd pleaser. It would have been something that Rachel knew audiences would resonate with. And here it is. Rachel was briefly famous in one place, but she wasn't a celebrity. Peter questions if she truly reached the heights of her potential.
So it's so curious to think of why she's not operating to the top level quite as much. Like, of course, we can't hear her, we can't know her story, which is just already fascinating. There's little tidbits like she lived kind of the Craig Gorman kind of area. Was she a top level artist who was like not allowed to sing in certain places because of, you know, where she was from or how she looked? One hopes not, but of course it's a very definite possibility. We see her build on some programs with Tenducci.
Tenducci was an Italian castrato, castrated as a young boy before puberty to retain a high vocal range. Yes, this practice is unthinkable today. He was like the Harry Styles of his time, a superstar. And he spent a lot of time in Ireland.
She was a huge hit in Kilkenny. There's this amazing poem written about her, and how, for at least the poet, it was like the highlight of the century is having her there, as well as Tenducci.
The poem that Peter's talking about was published in 1767 in Finn's Leinster Journal. And here it is.
Fame's done thee right. Thou hast the lulling art that can soft music's melody impart. Envy herself must thy perfections own, and say thou'rt worthy of the laurel crown. Let the white fair ones swell with proud disdain, despise thy colour and thy dusky mien. Yet what of that? Even these nor want their charms nor grace to lure the lover to thine arms.
But then Tenducci, there's something behind the scenes going on that he's not so happy to be on the same billing as her. In some of the press from that part of the country, he seems to be distancing himself a little bit from Rachel Baptist. Who knows why, but I've imagined that there might be a number of things at play there, and you know, you can't rule it out, but let's hope it wasn't like some racist reasons as well. But the thing was that she was, for the most part, it seems that she was very much accepted as a regular fitting in Ireland and hugely popular. Lots of actors and other people and newspaper reports mentioning her always in glowing terms. So, yeah, there are some missing pieces, and it's hard to know why she wasn't always in the top venues. It's difficult to know at this distance why.
While Peter speculates whether Rachel did reach the heights of her musical potential, it's clear from the sources that we do have that she was accepted in Irish society. At a time when the colour of your skin made you a commodity to be bought and sold. When racism was entrenched, not just in the minds of many, but in the world's economy. Why then was Rachel accepted here in Ireland by Irish people?
It is very interesting that she was so accepted into the theatre world of Dublin. Don't think Ireland is necessarily behind on ideas of liberty, equality and fraternity, and how they might be transferred very quickly into arguments about race also needing freedom and equality. You know, that black people should not be treated differently. There's very negative commentary on the slave trade from really quite an early date, you know, so that a lot of people are criticising the slave trade and slavery as a concept. So a good proportion of educated, enlightened people in Dublin, you know, which ended up as being very much a centre for revolutionary thought. It's also kind of clear that they weren't maybe completely racially segregated, because there weren't enough of them to make a complete, you know, to turn it into a big racially segregated system. You can't, why would you be bothered really essentially with so few? My sense is that there weren't necessarily enough black people to make them as different as they would have been in the longer centres of the slave trade, like Lisbon or Amsterdam. You know, some of the countries that got in first into colonisation and, you know, the exploitation of black and enslaved people are the places where you find a most mixed society, I think. So Ireland is just later coming to that table. I mean, there's different perspectives on how the different empires both set up their kind of racial systems, and the degree to which free blacks were tolerated.
Rachel's life is full of what-ifs, both her career and her personal life. There's a period of Rachel's life where she virtually disappears. And this is where William speculates.
I did wonder, between 1753 and 1755, there was about 18 months when she vanishes altogether. And I wondered if she had had a child, which prevented her performing. I've no reason to think that was the case, you know, but it's puzzling, this little hiatus in the middle of what was really quite a full career. And then she reappears again, sort of in 1755.
Yeah.
And it says, when she reappeared, that she hadn't been performing for, you know, this lengthy period of time, but no explanation why.
When Rachel came back from London, she was married. She was now Mrs. Crowe. We know that she was married to a musician named John Crowe, but that's all we do know about their relationship.
One thing that puzzles me is she came back in 1767, but she never performed in Dublin again. Why not? Had she in some way offended people? Had she crossed people in some way that she had to perform in Kilkenny and Limerick and Belfast? That does puzzle me. I thought, well, of course she would come back and then she'd be welcomed by the audiences in Dublin who had hailed her in the 1750s. But she didn't. And that is, I think, a mystery.
We still have questions about Rachel's life. There are pieces missing that we may never find, but what we do have is really important. Yes, Irish people loved her voice, but her legacy is about more than just music. Her story is a piece of Irish history that's gone under the radar. I always thought the first black people to come to Ireland were medical students in the 40s and 50s. And everyone else thought the first black Irish people were Phil Lynott and Paul McGrath. But Rachel's story has forced me to re-examine that. Rachel Baptiste makes us ask and try to get answers to bigger questions. Ireland's relationship with the slave trade, notions of race in Ireland, and when Ireland became a home for black people. Rachel is a window through which we can see an Ireland that maybe we've never seen before.
Thank you.
Black Siren was presented by Sive Downs and produced by Sive Downs with support from the Lyric Feature production team. Additional research and recordings by Michael Lee, and sound supervision was by Kieran Cullen. Much of the music in the programme was from the Irish Baroque Orchestra's recent release, Ireland's Black Siren, which features another Rachel, Rachel Redmond, singing songs that would or could have been sung by Rachel Baptiste at her performances. The Irish Baroque Orchestra styled themselves Ireland's time-travelling orchestra, and this is not the first time their well-researched works have informed and embellished our broadcasts on the Lyric Feature. So we are, as always, grateful to them for the permission to feature their music in our programmes, and to their artistic director, Peter Whelan, for his contribution here. You can find out more about the Irish Baroque Orchestra at irishbaroqueorchestra.com. We're also grateful to the singer Cliona Regan and harpsichordist Dylan Donegan, students at the Conservatoire of the Technological University of Dublin, who recorded two tracks for us, Eileen Aroon and Tell Me, Lovely Shepherd.